Blog Talk Radio.
Baltimore Sports and Life is dedicated to the analysis and discussion of the Baltimore Orioles,
the Baltimore Ravens,
and the University of Maryland.
Get the coverage you crave from our team of writers
and over 16 hours of live streaming content every week.
Every week.
Join the conversations on our message board, like BSL on Facebook, and follow BSL on Twitter. BaltimoreSportsAndLife.com.
Okay, welcome back. Welcome to Sports Tonight with Rob and Chris. We don't, unfortunately, have any guests tonight. However, Chris and I do have a ton of stuff to discuss, talking about the Orioles, talking about the NBA. The Terps decided to get one of the good guys from Duke to help them out. And, of course, we can get into Tom Brady and everything that he did. But let's start off with the Orioles. Just had a rough home road stretch here, especially the last six games. They went 1-5 in New York. They're 5.5 games back of the Yankees right now, last place in the division. Certainly not where you want to be right now, but it's still pretty early in the season. However, I guess one point to discuss is, you know, when is early no longer early and it becomes kind of a situation where, okay, now you really need to start doing some things because you don't want to fall back too far. So what are your thoughts on that, Chris?
Yeah, tonight's game, number 30, which represents just over 18% of the year. And when May ends, the Orioles will have played about 49 games, which will represent 30% of the season. So, you know, big jump just from here till a couple weeks to the end of the month. You know, I'm of the opinion that, you know, you can't win a pennant early, but you can lose it. And that, you know, these games matter. It's important to play and start improving the play, and you can't fall behind too much. But at the same time, I want to balance that out with what you said, that it is still fairly early, and, you know, you're cognizant of the fact that last year on June 6th, the Orioles were 6.5 games out of first and were in third place. But, you know, to me, what's important is the Orioles controlling their own level of play and, you know, that improving. And a lot of what is pointed out at our message board that I agree with is that the Orioles have been under Showalter traditionally, that they haven't beat themselves, and we've seen a fair amount of that over the last few weeks. Now, you take that with a little bit of a grain of salt, knowing that the lineup has had some disruptions and the defense as well. But now you've got Hardy back. Scope seems to be, you know, he's on the verge of baseball activities. Maybe he's on pace to get back June 1st, and we'll see about Wieters as well. So, hopefully, as you get get those bodies back, particularly having Hardy back, you know, we'll see less shooting yourself in the foot, and the Orioles can start to pick up the pace over these next few weeks.
Well, I think part of it too is what are the teams in front of you doing? You know, we're seeing what the Yankees are doing, which is really surprising everybody. Are they going to be able to stay at the? You know, they're not going to play over 600 baseball. But are they going to be able to be a 90-ish win team? I mean, you know, coming into the season, when you talked about New York, you talked about, you know, what were they going to get out of Tanaka, what were they going to get out of Pineda, and what were they going to get out of Sabathia? If they were going to be able to get good production from those three, they should be pretty decent. I mean, they've got an incredible back end of the bullpen. Their defense has greatly improved. So, you know,
and they got a representative lineup. I saw you make that point on the board, and I completely agree. I definitely had the Yankees coming into the year. I thought they could be potentially an 85-win team. What I saw was a lot of age at the lineup, and I'm a Tanaka fan, but I just didn't believe in his ability to stay healthy. And I like Pineda, and I mentioned him last year, but he missed all of 12, all of 13, and then last year he had like 75 innings. So my question was, how many innings can he give you this year? But yeah, I think you're completely right, Rob, that they are exceeding expectations right now. And you got to wonder, you know, are they going to continue to do that the rest of the year?
Yeah, I mean, I think people underrated Tampa a little bit. Yes, their offense wasn't good, but their pitching should be very good. The other teams in the division are fine. you know, this is a race that should stay relatively close. But if some team, like say the Yankees, say just like the Orioles did last year where they went ran out and won 96 games and won the division easily, if some team is going to get well into the 90s and wins, everybody else is probably going to be left in the dust a little bit, similar to last year. So, you know, you look at the Orioles right now, they're plus +5 in run differential. So the Pythagorean theorem would say your record is better than 13-16. However, that's skewed early on, especially when you consider the Boston game where they scored 18 runs, and then you followed it up with the White Sox game where there was nobody in the stands. So all of a sudden, you know, you outscore those teams by 15-ish runs, whatever it is, and, you know, now it looks, okay, we'll really take those two games out, and it's in the negative, you know, pretty easily. So it's not as a point of panicking, but I do think it's fair to question the roster, how it was put together. I do think it's fair to worry about a few of the guys on this team. You know, a guy like Bud Norris, you know, his track record is one of a league average or so pitcher. This is not an outstanding track record. It's a decent one. Nobody should be surprised if he all of a sudden falls off. It just should not be a surprise. Pitchers like him have bad years all the time. And we're going to have to endure him for probably a good another 3 to 4 weeks worth of starts. And if he doesn't turn it around, how much is that going to bury the bullpen and bury the rotation a little bit early on? And you might get out of, you might dig yourself into a hole that is difficult to get out of. So they really got to make sure that they start winning someone like this homestand, for example, and things like that, because you don't want to fall too far behind.
Yeah, I am in agreement with you there. And regarding Norris, you know, I think it's a fair point that I think on his best days he can look like a 2 or 3, but his track record overall suggests he's more of a 4 or 5. So, you know, right now he's giving you 4-inning outings, which that's an issue. And you know, it was discussed at the message board today about how, as Gausman gets healthy, he's going to go to Norfolk and get stretched out. So you're probably right that, and I liked your post that you had, that that's really just putting the starters on notice. And, you know, 3-4 weeks from now, that you'll maybe there's a decision to be made at that point.
Well, you know, obviously the starting pitching is going to, I mean, we saw it looking like it was going to start to get better. It wasn't like awful on this last 6 games, but it obviously was a little bit below where you want it to be. That's going to obviously be a key too. If they turn it around and we're talking a few months from now, we're in All-Star break time and the Orioles are in that playoff positioning, you know, obviously the rotation pitching better is going to have to be part of that. But what else do you see that has to improve for this team to get to that point?
Yeah, I really am starting with the rotation though. I mean, because you enter tonight, you're second in slugging, you're 6th in on-base percentage, you're 12th in runs. I think the runs will improve. I do think the on-base percentage is going to take a drop. But where you're really negative is you're 22nd in ERA.
Hello?
Hello?
Sorry, my mistake.
Yeah, no problem. But you're 22nd in ERA, you're 23rd in starting ERA. And the reason the Orioles took off last year was after the All-Star break, they led the majors in the ERA. Now, I didn't buy that they were that staff in the second half, but I also don't buy that they're, you know, the 23rd best starting staff right now. You know, I think if they can get closer to the middle point, you know, somewhere around 15th overall, I think the offense and defense is strong enough that that should boost them overall. But to me, that's really what I'm keying on over this next, you know, if I look ahead over this next 2 months.
Yeah, I mean, every start that he makes, I feel better and better that Jimenez is going to be able to have a pretty good year. Now, how you want to define pretty good is up for debate. I would just define it as a guy who could push 200 innings and have a 4 ERA or better. So, I mean, you know,
yeah, he looked great in the first night with that movement, a little extra velocity, and he's not beating himself. I mean, the walks are more back in line with his career averages. So, yeah, you should be having additional confidence. But to me, you know, you mentioned Norris, and then it's and then I guess, you know, we're going to see Tillman, and you need Tillman to be what he's been since he came back up in the All-Star break of 2012.
Yeah, to me, I mean, that's what I was going to say. To me, it almost all goes back to Tillman. You know, right now he's 2-4 with whatever you care about that. He's had six starts, but he's only got 31 and two-thirds innings pitched. So he's just pitching over five innings a start, which is not what you want out of him. His ERA over six, but even worse than the ERA, he's got a walk rate is over five. His strikeout rate is down a little bit from where his career is, but basically it's where it was last year. You know, he's always going to give up his fair share of home runs, but the walks are just absolutely killing him, and he's not able to get deep in games or anything. He has got to turn it around, because if you don't have him turning it around, and you don't know what you're going to get out of Norris or Gausman or whoever is going to be in that spot, now you're looking at three guys. One of them, Miguel Gonzalez, is very good when he pitches, but he's not a guy that consistently can go deep in the games every night. So you're going back to Chen and Ubaldo as your two reliable guys that can maybe get you six-plus innings a night, and that's just not enough. This team is built to where these starters have to, A, stay healthy, and, B, they have to pitch, you know, deep in the games and
they have to
well.
Keep you in. They have to keep you in games.
Absolutely.
They don't have to be. They don't have to be excellent, but they can't go out early. And somebody like Tillman, one of the primary attributes that he's provided over these last couple of years is innings and being a consistent starter. And when he goes out early, that just puts that much stress on the bullpen and those starters behind him. And as you said, if you have turmoil behind him in the rotation, it becomes a domino effect. So yeah, right now Chen and Jimenez, they're kind of keeping you afloat, and you need and Gonzalez has been strong as well. But as you said, there's kind of a you know, Gonzalez has said this year his goal is 200 innings, but you know, we need to see that first. I mean, right now, 160, 170 innings probably seems like a more likely goal for. A likely result for him.
Yeah. Gonzalez gives you like 2-3 starter like stats in terms of just like ERA, what he's going to do for you and all, but he gives you 4-5 starter innings. So you really want to rely on him more as the back, you know, in that back end of the rotation and not in the front of the rotation. Right now they kind of have to rely on him in that, and you don't want that. You know, the opposite of this is if this rotation doesn't turn around, this team's going to be out of it by the All-Star break. There's a very good chance of that if the rotation doesn't turn around, because chances are there's going to be at least one and probably two AL East teams that are going to start to assert themselves by the All-Star break. So if
you get to the middle of July, 2 months from now, and the Orioles still look off, let's say they've even improved, but they don't look like a bona fide contender, what are the moves you're looking to make at that point? Looks like I may have lost Rob.
Sorry about that. Welcome back. I got kicked off again. Somebody's calling me and it's knocking me off of the Skype. Are you back, Chris?
I am, Rob. No problem. So what we were just talking about there was the idea that if we get 2 months from now, the Orioles, for whatever reason, maybe they've looked improved, but they still don't look like a bona fide contender. At that point, what moves are you looking to make prior to the trade deadline?
I mean, I'm dumping anybody that you don't deem as part of the future, provided that whoever it is that you're trading, if they're up for draft pick compensation and you're going to offer the qualifying offer in all likelihood, that what you're getting in return is worth more than the draft pick. You know, we'll see if Wieters gets back in time and if he looks productive and that type of thing. If so, he's gone. Chris Davis, gone. Norris, well, Norris may not have, you know, chances are he may not have much value at that point. But, you know, if he happens to rebound a little bit and you can get something, he should be gone. I'm looking, you know, the bottom line is this team after this year is a complete and utter unknown, and you have a relatively poor farm system with some intriguing prospects, but it's pretty poor. They gave away the number 74 pick this year for nothing because they're cheap. So, you know, you've got to replenish this team. And, you know, it was fine to go for this team this year, go for things this year, which you can debate if they actually went for it. But if you're not in it, then you have got to build for the future. And, you know, and that starts at the deadline. You don't have to do everything at the deadline, but you have got to shop as many people. Oh, and O'Day is another guy who could maybe bring you more value than you think. You know, all those guys, everybody should be on the trading block as long as you don't think they're a major part of the future.
Yeah, but just as I'm posing the question, you know, the one aspect we're mentioning there is the idea that the Orioles definitely don't look like a contender. What's more likely would be somewhere where the Orioles are kind of trapped in the middle, where they don't look like a real contender at that point. Maybe they're outside of the playoff position, but they're close enough, because everybody's close enough for that second wild card, that they, at that point, feel like they have to, go add further. So that'll be an interesting scenario. I hope that the Orioles are kind of in an either-or situation at that point, where they are a playoff in playoff position, or they definitely look like it's outside the realm of possibility. So, and not kind of trapped in that middle spot where I think they would probably look to augment instead of paring down.
Yeah, I mean, to me, a bad scenario is 2013. You know, yes, the team won 85 games. Yes, you had a representative season, much better than what we have been used to over the last 15, 20 years. But the problem is, at least heading into 2014, you could point and say, okay, you have Wieters, you had Davis. You know, at that point, you had Hardy, and you knew you had him for another year. I mean, you felt good about things, where you can say, okay, well, you know, we were in the playoffs last year, we had a representative season this year, let's see what we can do next year with this group of players. But you don't have that to point to next year. I mean, you're losing Chen, you're losing, you know, O'Day. I mean, you're losing so many guys. So, you know, you don't know what Steve Pierce you're going to have. I mean, you just don't know any of that stuff. So you can't hold on to these guys thinking, you know, hey, we maybe we can make a push and, you know, have some miraculous back end of the season. I mean, you have to at some point be a little realistic and understand that you're a team that is very strapped for the long term, and, you know, you've got to get some.
Yeah, I tend to agree if you're across the board there, Rob. And what I would put back to the Orioles is you have 2 months to show what you are. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you show to be a contender, then, you know, your team's not going to be blowing up underneath you. But if you spend the next 2 months playing mediocre, then, you know, somebody internally, you know, the cat has to look at the longer-term future. And as you mentioned previously, you have a system that's definitely in the lower third of baseball overall, and you have a lot of roster turnover coming. So if you can add some additional depth to the system, cheap team-controlled players, it would be hard at that point to say no to that strategy. So 9-game homestand beginning tonight. Orioles finally back home, reopening day. Beginning this 3-game series versus Toronto, followed by 6 against AL West, 3 versus LA, and then 3 versus Seattle. To me, you know, we're talking about wanting to start to see the play improve. What are you basically looking for in this homestand?
Well, for one, obviously, you want to see improved pitching. I mean, you know, we're off to a good start tonight. Ubaldo's, you know, he hasn't let up anything through 4 innings. He's got 6 Ks. He's only walked 1, given up 2 hits. So you know, you're off to a good start there. You know, there's a good chance that Ubaldo can get deep into this game, you know, which will help the bullpen. You know, look, you first of all, Toronto has beat the hell out of us this year, so you would really like to at least win the series here to kind of start getting something back in the division. You know, the Angels and the Mariners have not been as good as people thought, at least not yet. Seattle can pitch, but their pitching hasn't been great thus far. They have struggled to hit. Obviously, Nelson Cruz is having a monster year, so, you know, he'll be back. But neither one of those teams are off to great starts. Only Houston is above 500 out in the AL West, the last time I looked.
You're right. You're looking for series wins, you know.
Yep.
Start putting together series.
It's imperative for them to start. You know, you have to start getting moving here. Just like we said, it is early, but again, you're already 5.5 out. You know, you blink your eye, you have a little bit more of a bad stretch. You're 8-9 games out. That's going to be very tough to dig your way out of. It's not impossible, but it's difficult. The Angels right now, they have a -3 run differential. The Mariners have a -20 run differential right now. These teams, they're not playing great baseball. Seattle has won 3 in a row, but still, they're overall not playing great baseball. So you've got to jump on these teams now, and you know, you got to take advantage of them while they're down, and that's imperative for the Orioles to do on this homestand, because you know, hopefully the crowds and being back in Baltimore and everything else will really help them too.
Well, let's look past Baltimore in the East a little bit and discuss the rest of the AL. Let's start in the Central. Obviously, Kansas City's leading. Detroit's on the heels. Twins surging a bit, and everybody was on Cleveland's bandwagon to start the year. They are 8 games under 500 and 8.5 out. How do you currently see the Central?
Yeah, I mean, Cleveland's pretty terrible. Their pitching has been bad. Corey Kluber has not been good. The strikeout rate is still pretty decent, but, you know, his numbers are not good. The White Sox, I thought they would be a little bit better. The Twins probably are the most surprising team in the American League next to Houston. Kansas City is, look, they're a team, I mean, right now they're already +47 in run differential. That's pretty crazy this early in the season to be that high up already. You know, their pitching is very good. They're hitting. Eric Hosmer has been off to a blitzing start. So, you know, this is they're a very good team. You know, we all want to talk about how the Orioles aren't going to beat themselves. Neither is Kansas City. They play better. They play better defense than the Orioles do. They have a better bullpen than the Orioles do. This is a team. They're not going to go away. I actually had Kansas City. I think I had them missing the play. I had Cleveland winning this division, and I didn't have Detroit making the playoffs at all because I thought that Detroit would fall back. I think I picked them to finish third in the division. So they're off to, I wouldn't call it surprising necessarily, but they're off to a better than I would have expected type start. I'm a little skeptical on how much they'll be able to keep it up.
Yeah, Kansas City, they're dealing with the loss of Garza, and they've been able to move past that. I thought that was impressive. It's an interesting division. I mean, I think Cleveland can kind of play their way back into that. But like we've talked about, the Orioles are already digging a pretty significant hole. So it's it's early, but it's not that early.
Yeah, and I mean, the thing is with Cleveland, I mean, you know, they're 2 behind the White Sox, who are above them, but then they're 6 behind the Twins, and they're 7 behind Detroit. So, I mean, at least with the Orioles are only 2.5 games out of second. So, you know, yes, they have to leap teams, but everybody is kind of, like, jumbled there, whereas there's distance already in that AL Central, and that's tough.
With the multiple teams in front to have to climb, so... Yeah, it really starts with their own play, and then I don't know how many division games they have left, but they'll have to do work there.
Yeah, I mean, no doubt. I mean, it's just like the Orioles. It goes back to the rotation. Their rotation has got to step up and pitch a lot better. I mean, Danny Salazar had a big game yesterday. You know, if they're able to start getting him and Kluber can get back to where he was, all of a sudden, if you can have 2 top of the rotation guys like that, that'll certainly do wonders for him. But let's move to the West. You know, the most surprising team in baseball has to be the Astros. They're playing at a very, very high level. They're 20-12. They're tied for the second most wins in all of Major League Baseball, behind only the Cardinals. Several teams have 20 wins, but you know, they're the surprise. And then the next, maybe this division as a whole is maybe the biggest surprise. I mean, Oakland is already 8.5 out. They're terrible. Seattle struggled. The Angels struggled, like we talked about. You'd expect the Texas not to be that great, and Houston all of a sudden is on the top. So this division is completely upside down right now.
Yeah, I've been saying for a couple of years that I, you know, I like Houston. I think they're coming. I didn't really expect them to be running away with the West this year. They're 8 games over 500. Springer's been poor, and he's on the DL. Castro's struggling. But Dallas Kuchel has been awesome. I really like that guy. Colin McHugh's been solid. The rest of the rotation kind of looks like smoke and mirrors. You know, Feldman. Right now they're pitching very well. They're 5th overall in quality starts, but I look at the rotation and it's, you know, I see some problems like at some point during the year. I like Altuve, and not just because he's around my height. Jake Marcinik is center field. He's got an on-base percentage about .364. Rasmus has been solid. And today they just promoted Carlos Correa to AAA, so he's on the way, not too far away. And Mark Apple, he's in AA and doing okay. But 10th overall in runs, 9th in slugging. The on-base percentage is low. But the pitching, as we said, that's been very strong. 8th in ERA, 5th in quality starts. And then you mentioned it earlier, the other 4 teams in the division, each of them under 500, each of them with a negative run differential. If you look at L.A., Seattle, and Texas, they are – L.A.'s 24th in runs, Seattle's 25th, Texas is 21st. I mean, pretty brutal offenses out there. You know, Seattle being 25th in runs and 15th in slugging with the start that Cruz has had, that's – I mean, it just shows you just one guy just can't carry an offense no matter how great production that they have. You know, all the teams have some pitching. LA, a couple, you know, they got 3 decent starters, although Weaver's kind of, he's definitely regressed. Wilson looks to be improved a little bit this year, and Richards, he's back from his injury. Oakland, they're at the bottom of the division, in 9 games under 500, but they're 4th in runs. They're 14th in slugging. Their on-base percentage is 18th. And they're, you know, 13th in quality starts. I think it's a little early to bury the A's. I could see them potentially rebounding and factoring in that division where every team appears to have some issues. So somebody could get hot, and I definitely think Houston will kind of come back to the pack as well.
Yeah, I mean, Houston coming back to the pack is almost a guarantee. Even if they're a surprise team, I mean, they're a team that's been building. They've got young talent. You know, if all of a sudden a bunch of these guys start, you know, performing, you know, you can jump up quickly. We saw it with Tampa Bay back in 08, you know, just kind of almost out of nowhere, but you knew it was going to be happening at some point. You know, you mentioned that Cruz is off to a big year, is off to a big start, but Cano is off to a bad start. So they're kind of canceling each other out right now, I guess, because, I mean, he's only got a 700 OPS. Slugging's way down. The on-base percentage is way down. So, you know, I would tend to agree that, you know, a couple of those teams are going to get rolling at some point. I still think it's Seattle's division to win because I think their pitching is just too good. It'll eventually, James Paxton is off to an uneven start, and he'll, you know, he didn't really pitch a whole lot last year, so he'll get going. They've got Felix. I mean, they'll get going. They'll be okay.
I think the only team you can eliminate is Texas. Yeah, definitely there. It's pretty amazing that they have 12 guys on the DL with a number of them out for the year. I mean, that's too much for any team to deal with.
Yeah, they're in trouble. I mean, they just don't have enough right now. You know, they're taking a Hail Mary with Josh Hamilton, which is maybe not a terrible thing because they're not going to have to pay him anything. And if, you know, if he can even be okay, it's a good deal for them. So, you know, it's probably worth a try. And, you know, as they get guys back and maybe they can make some moves, you know, you kind of wonder, do they look to try to move Prince Fielder at some point? They wanted some salary relief and maybe try to get some prospects back if he's playing at a high enough level to do that. I mean, you know, at some point you got to start to make some of these moves. But it's amazing how quickly they've dropped, because this was an organization that not that long ago we were talking about all the young talent they had coming up. You know, they had all this money from their TV deal, and they were just going to become
this
juggernaut.
And the front office as well, that was extremely highly regarded. And, of course, injuries is quite the equalizer. But somebody like Sinsu Chu, who we debated heavily at the BSL board. They invested a lot of money. It was their money to invest, and he's been, he was poor last year, and he was off to an abysmal start this year, the last I looked.
Yeah, I mean, he's been bad. You're not getting much out of Andrews. The real big loss for them that nobody really talks about, because he hasn't been playing basically for the last 2 years, is Profar. You know, he was the guy that was supposed to be their next stud, and
right.
You know, he missed pretty much all of last year, and he's going to miss all of this year. So, I mean, that's tough. It's tough on the organization. And then you had Derek Holland missing a lot of time. He was missed a lot of time. Matt Harrison missed a ton of time. You know, all of a sudden, all of these injuries have come at one time. I mean, Feliz was out for a while. Now he's back, but they have to put him as a closer, not as a starter. You know, I mean, your best player is your 37-ish-year-old third baseman who continues to play at a pretty high level. But you know, he's got a big contract. So, you know,
and
I mean,
of course, Darvish as well.
Right. Yeah. True. Yeah. So, I mean, it's tough. I mean, it's very tough when you know you're talking about your, and not only your best players, but young guys that you thought you were going to be able to build with for several years, and now all of a sudden you can't point to any of them and expect any of them to give you any production for the next several years. It's their organization, and just a few years, you know, since losing to the Orioles, you know, in that wild card game, you know, at least they got back to the playoffs and everything. They had the disappointing World Series loss and stuff like that. They got back to the playoffs. They lost that game, and ever since then, it's been totally downhill for that organization.
That was
but,
fun.
All right, let's take a quick break here, and when we get back, we'll get into some football talk.
Baltimore Sports and Life is dedicated to the analysis and discussion of the Baltimore Orioles, the Baltimore Ravens, and the University of Maryland. Get the coverage you crave from our team of writers and over 16 hours of live streaming content every week. Every week. Join the conversations on our message board, like BSL on Facebook, and follow BSL on Twitter. BaltimoreSportsAndLife.com.
Okay, let's welcome back. Let's get into some rapid fire type questions about the Ravens. Let's start off, Chris. Cornerback depth behind what we have with Webb and Smith. How do you feel about it?
Yeah, I'm a little scared about that. I mean, I think Melvin showed some signs the end of last year, and Ace Jackson, if he could ever stay on the field, I think there is something there. And of course, Walker, what we've just taken in the draft. He does have some physical attributes, but like you, I want another veteran cornerback added. And, of course, late this afternoon we saw in the news that New England had released Arrington, and I like that he's it seems to be some posters on the board that were apprehensive because he was a slot corner. To me, that's kind of what they need, unless you're going to move Webb inside. So I hope the Ravens are jumping on that, and if they add another veteran starting caliber quarterback, to me you need three. I'm going to feel that much better about the Ravens' chances to do some significant damage this year. I saw a post that you made the other day on the board, and I forget the cornerback that you had mentioned that they potentially could have signed last year, and your feelings that if they had signed him potentially, you know, they beat New England in that playoff game, don't suffer the multiple comebacks there from the Patriots. And it's just right now in the NFL with the proliferation of the passing games being spread out, you have to have three that you feel good about. And, of course, Webb, he played better at the end of last year, but he struggled to start the year. You're hoping that he physically is ready to take that next leap and get back to pretty close to what he once was. And Smith, obviously, they've given the contract. The Ravens believe in him. When he's on the field, he's nail merch is one of the better corners in the league. But, again, he's coming off another injury, and he's missed time previously. So, yeah, give me another starting caliber guy that you can feel good about, and I'll feel much better. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I mean, I think people need to remember that, you know, our cornerbacks, you know, our issue last year, the guy I mentioned was Brandon Flowers. I mean, I feel pretty good if he was going to be able to start instead of Melvin last year, that, you know, we would have been in a lot better shape. So, you know, we're fine with who we have starting, but we definitely need that next guy. And the one thing I mentioned about Arrington, too, is he is from Maryland, so maybe there's some thought of him coming back into the – I mean, it's from Southern Maryland, so it's not necessarily the area, but it's still the same state. So maybe he would – you know, maybe that would be another way to draw him in here.
Let's look on the offensive side. One of the more interesting players for me is Juszczyk. Do you think he should be more involved with the offense? And if so, how would you use him?
Well, I mean, we've seen that he can be a matchup problem for teams because, you know, if you put a linebacker on him, he's going to be too quick for him. If you put him with a safety or a corner, he's too big for him. You know, we didn't really see much with him in terms of running the ball, but, you know, dropping the ball off to him. I mean, look, the bottom line is this. He is a guy I would much rather throw the ball to than Vontae Leach, yet we used to throw the ball to Vontae Leach all the time for some reason.
Like 20 times a year.
Yeah, he caught more passes in a year here than he would in, like, his entire career everywhere else. So I wouldn't mind using him more often. Now, that being said, you just drafted a young tight end. You've got Gilmore. You've got a ton of receivers to go to. You've got – now you have two running backs that can catch the ball well out of the backfield. So, you know, Juszczyk is a guy that I would like to see them use, and he could be a guy that, you know, all of a sudden, you know, a play or two a game, you know, they're not expecting it. You get him the ball, but – there's only one ball to go around, and there are a lot of other playmakers on the field that, you know, and he's not necessarily the top of your list as the guy to go to, but you don't ignore him either.
Yeah, fair points there. Just going into a third year, and we're never going to discuss the tight ends. To me, with his skill set, if the tight ends are a little slow in coming around, he's somebody that you need to figure out a way to get the ball to more.
Yeah, and that can go into the next question. So, you know, you've got Williams, the rookie, and then you're going to have Gilmore, the second-year guy, who showed some flashes, but obviously you need to see him take the next step. So are you comfortable with those two guys as your primary tight end?
You know, you want the tight ends to be those safety valves for the quarterback and be able to run the seams and also be able to block. I'm not sure about Trestman's offense, but Trestman's supposed to be kind of a carryover to Kubiak, and there was a fair amount of the two tight end sets. What you like about Gilmore Williams is that, you know, Gilmore's 6'6", Williams is 6'4". They both, maybe they're not superior athletes, but they're both, they're not slow either. So, good size, able to run a little bit. To me, it's pretty imperative in camp for Flacco to get some type of relationship going with those two. Gilmore is the one coming in with the additional experience. As far as being comfortable, I mean, Gilmore had 10 receptions last year. Williams is a rookie, so if I like both of them. Williams was drafted as first tight end in this draft, and Gilmore he certainly showed some flashes last year. So I like them both, but as comfort, it's kind of just picking a little bit. But if you're looking at things to pick at about why the Ravens, you know things that could potentially hold the Ravens back, that's something to look at.
Yeah, like you said, I mean, maybe you use Juszczyk a little bit in that role. You know, but I think you have to like the fact, you know, Flacco seemed to get a little bit more familiar and confident with Gilmore as that season went on last year. You know, some of that out of necessity because guys were hurt and things of that nature. But, you know, I don't want to say I don't know if I'd use the word comfortable necessarily because you still need to see these guys perform. But I think their abilities are there to where I feel better about those two than I did about Pitta and Dixon back when they were rookies. So I feel better there because these guys, I think that there's more skill there, especially like, you know, maybe not more necessarily than Pitta, but, you know, as you're going into this season, I think you feel better about those two specific tight ends personally. Although Dixon at least was a highly regarded guy, we just didn't know he didn't know how to catch.
Well, you mentioned Pitta, and let's stick to the tight ends. Let's say Pitta does return, and he is able to stay on the field. What's the impact to the roster then?
You know, that's a really good question because, you know, they're not going to get rid of either Gilmore or Williams. That's a given. You know, you do start to wonder, is Juszczyk going to be the guy who's the odd man out? Unless he's, you know, unless you just want to keep him around for special teams. You know, are you going to cut one of the young receivers that you like? I don't really know. I think it's an excellent question. My guess is that you're not going to cut Pitta. You're not going to eat the salary. So what my guess is that probably it's going to affect special teams. There's going to be a guy on, you know, like last year we kept a guy like a Zach Orr specifically for special teams. So my guess is somebody like that doesn't make the roster, and that can hurt special teams a little bit. That would be my guess as of right now.
Yeah, that's where I think you'd potentially see somebody. I'm looking at the maybe the receiving corps being pared down. It's interesting. I mean, I don't expect Pitta to come back, but he's going to try. After last year where he did get back on the field and you just saw it happen again, I mean, that's just it's really hard to have any confidence that he's going to be able to, A, get back to the field, and B, stay on the field if he does. But
yeah, I mean, you have to assume right now that he starts the year on the PUP list, okay? So that's going to give you 6 weeks to make a decision on what you do. See some of these young guys, make a decision there. I think you're definitely going to see that. It's the question will be is if after that 6 weeks, if he's healthy, then where do you go? I think there's a good, that's going to be their best way to be able to delay the decision, I think, because I just can't imagine a scenario where they're going to go into the season saying, yep, he's going to be one of our best 53. We're totally confident that he's healthy and be ready to go. And quite frankly,
well, that's an excellent point there about the pup list and delaying the decision there.
Yeah, and I'll tell you what the other thing is we're not mentioning is Thad Boyle, who they liked and they drafted in the fifth round. And, you know, I don't think they probably just want to lose him. So
right.
I don't think the Ravens think there's a chance that Pitt is playing. I mean, I really don't. So, you know...
The second tight end is kind of a pretty good giveaway.
Yeah, I mean that's got to be the way it goes. So let's look on the defensive side of the ball. Where do you see the pass rush right now once you get past Doom and Suggs?
To me, I mean, it's going to start with Jernigan, who that was an interesting aspect when he did replace Nada last year. He was able to collapse the pocket from inside, which then really allowed the outside rushers to get after quarterbacks. But you start there, and then there is some pressure on Za'Darius Smith to be able to come in right away, especially in your third down packages, and be able to bring a little bit of a pass rush. You know, we talked last week about how he's been compared to McPhee. It might be unfair to compare him to last year's McPhee, who was like a fourth-year player, but let's go back to McPhee's rookie year where Purnell did provide some pass rush there as a rookie, and that's what you're looking for out of Smith. And, you know, you look at the roster, and you're probably going to need that out of him.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Courtney Upshaw saw a little bit more pass rush out of him last year. I don't think you really assume he's really going to do too much, though. He's more of an edge setter. I think you hit on the nose with Jernigan, but not just Jernigan, just general up the middle push. I think the one thing that people, when they look at the Ravens roster, need to pay attention to, especially if guys like Kaffrin Lewis-Moore are healthy and Brett Urban are healthy, they are going to be a very physically imposing defensive line. And that alone, these guys are going to tie up three and four blockers on the offensive line. And that's going to free up all sorts of guys. You may not have a third guy that you point to and say, that guy is going to be a dominant pass rusher. But you might be able to point to several guys and say, you know what, they're going to be able to get to the quarterback just because there's not enough blockers up there. I mean, Brandon Williams has taken up two guys. There's no doubt about it. So, you know, then what, Jernigan's going to get one-on-one with some guard? I mean, that's a mismatch in most of the time. So, I mean, I would have liked to have seen him add another pass rusher at some, you know, a guy like Dwight Freeney. I don't think he's been signed. You know, do they go after somebody like that to add to that? But, I mean, I think you have to like just the idea of just dominance and strength that you have up the middle and them being able to lock up blockers and guys like Mosley and people like that being able to run freely and get after the quarterback that way.
We'll bounce back to the offense. Our Ravens colleagues at BSL, Sean Brubaker and Jordan Coe, last couple of days, a couple of columns on potential camp battles. One of them, how about Taliaferro versus Allen? Who do you see as the kind of the thumper back behind Forsett.
Well, we got to remember that Taliaferro did do some very good things last year. I think there's a good chance that Taliaferro will win the job as the second running back in the beginning. I think what's going to end up happening is Forsett is going to be a guy, you're going to have to spell him quite often, whether it's because he's out of games, because he's injured, whether it's because you have to give him more rest than maybe a normal number one running back or whatever. Booz Allen will be definitely a third down back quite often because of his ability to catch. He's probably going to be the better runner than Taliaferro, but Taliaferro is probably going to be your better short yardage guy right now. So I think it's going to depend on the situation. It's going to depend on the game. And it's going to depend on the defenses that they're playing. I would guess early on it's Taliaferro as getting the edge because he's got the experience. He knows it is a new offense, but it's a similar offense than what we had. So I would say he's got the slight edge, but I think by midseason, Allen will be the definite number two running back, and it wouldn't surprise me if Forsett is banged up or he's not performing as well as we think that Allen is the number one running back at some point, even though I did feel that they could have gone different directions, but obviously the Ravens really liked him.
Yeah, so, all fair across the board there. Taliaferro did show some things while he was healthy last year, and both of them being one-cut runners is kind of interesting, and Taliaferro has the additional experience of that extra year. I kind of feel Allen probably has the higher upside, and I think you kind of hit on the more interesting aspect, which is if Forsett comes back to earth a little bit this year you can have a number of reasons why they could happen. Maybe Allen winds up being the guy that's more likely to get a larger amount of carries.
Yeah, and his ability to catch the ball out of the backfield, a big thing in a Trestman offense. We saw that with Forte and all. So, that's pretty cool. That's pretty crucial to him. Now, getting over to the receiving core, obviously we know that, they're going to rely on Steve Smith. Perriman is going to get a lot of snaps this year. But then you have that group of guys like Kamar Aiken and Campanaro and Marlon Brown. Whose production out of that group of guys do you think is going to be most important, and who do you think is going to end up standing out of that group?
I could answer that in a number of different ways. Because you have Brown with the length, and he's already had the production 2 years ago, and then last year, at the start of last year, he wasn't involved in the offense at all, and then at the end of the last year, he was coming on. Aiken had 24 catches last year, 15 of them were for first downs. Brown had 24 as well, 16 first downs. I guess I'm going to go with Campanaro, which is more of a wild card to me, just the idea of Smith and Perriman, they're both going to challenge receivers down the field. To me, you need that underneath receiver, which should be Campanaro. And he's more of a wild card because you've got to question his ability to stay on the field until he shows he can do it. But I really like his ability, and second year now, having some time with Flacco, I think there's a chance that he really emerges as a playmaker in this offense.
I think all of these receivers bring you similar things, but do it in different ways. I mean, Marlon Brown has been a very good over-the-middle, third-down type guy. Like you said, he's got good height. Maybe he's a guy that you'll utilize in the red zone a little bit more. Aiken is similar to that. Campanaro is your quick twitch, slot guy, kind of like a Courtney Hawkins and you hope that he could develop into an Edelman or a Welker or somebody like that. You've brought up that play several times where he caught that ball in the end zone last year where he jumped up, showed some hops on that. A lot of upside there with all of these guys. They may not have that upside of a number two or better receiver, but they all have an upside in that they can pose matchup problems in different ways. And if Perriman is a threat this year, and they were talking about how he looked good in camp over the weekend, catching the ball and things like that. If he is a threat immediately and can really come in and perform well, then those guys are all going to get single covered. And most of the time, those guys are not only going to get single covered, it's going to be single covered with linebackers and safeties, and those guys will have no chance to cover them. So they have the opportunity to make a lot of big plays and a lot of big catches. But, you know, all of them have to stay on the field because they've had their injury issues, especially Brown and Campanaro, and they have to continue to develop their games and things. So a lot of this is going to be on them because they're going to throw the ball a lot. So they need all of these guys. So it's going to be – and oh, and then, of course, you're also going to have the tight ends that are going to go down the seam, and they're going to take away some guys. So these guys are going to be one-on-one covered, linebackers, defensive ends, things like that, and those should be mismatches every time.
And probably the true answer is that all three of them, as you're alluding to, they'll all have their opportunities, and maybe the answer of who will emerge will be on a week-to-week basis, depending on the matchups.
Yeah, and it'll also and it'll be who does Flacco have confidence in? Who's the guy that he knows if I throw it to him, he's going to catch it? I don't have to worry about him dropping the ball, running wrong routes, or anything like that. And that's obviously going to be huge. And it's good for both of these, that for all three of these guys, that now it's multiple years into the system or getting with Flacco and stuff like that, as opposed to Aiken and Camp last year, which is their first years. So, you know, so that's more experience and more knowledge is obviously going to be key here. So before we get into the Tom Brady thing, let's quickly go over, if you look at the rest of the division, what are your general thoughts for these teams that they've done their drafts and everything else? Start with the Steelers. They won the division last year. You know, they had a, by all accounts, it seems like they had a pretty decent draft. They had good news that Polamalu retired this all season. So where do you see Pittsburgh as you start heading into the camp season?
Well, I know one of our writers, Will Stokes, has a Q&A coming with a couple of Steelers writers, and as a group, we were talking about prospective questions for them. And one of the things you start looking at the Steelers is, you mentioned Polamalu, but it's been an off season of change for them. They've it wasn't just Polamalu; they lost the other safety that I'm forgetting about, or corner.
Ike Taylor.
Right, and then LeBeau left for Tennessee. You know, that'll be a change. All the years of seeing him running the Steelers defense. They also lost the edge rusher who kind of surprised them with, you know, with the early retirement. But they replaced him with Bud Dupree. They got Sammy Coates in the draft. We talked a little bit about him last week. You know, somebody we had also reviewed on the site. He was, you know, in some ways he's got a similar type of skill set to like a Perriman, you know, a bigger guy, some speed, ability to stretch the field, and they got him in the third round. Obviously, the skill position talent for the Steelers is pretty strong right now, but their defense was a freaking train wreck last year with a bunch of old legs. So I was a little bit surprised they didn't. I mean, the first two picks, they got Dupree, and then the second pick, they had a cornerback, Golson, out of Ole Miss, and then they went cornerback again in the fourth after Coates. They need some of these young players to come in and be able to make plays immediately, because that's – you know, you look at the defense, that's not a traditional Steelers team. That's they're definitely built around their offense right now with Roethlisberger, Bell, and Brown, you know, and then Wheaton as well.
Yeah, I mean, look, like you said, the offense should be pretty dynamic last year. You know, they don't have Le'Veon Bell for the first few weeks. They caught a break with the Brady news today about the suspension, so they don't have to play Brady in week one, so that's obviously pretty big for them. But it does. It comes back to their defense. I mean, you know, Bud Dupree is looked at as a guy with a lot of upside, but he's also looked at as a very raw guy. So, I mean, what are you going to get out of him immediately? You know, Jarvis Jones has been a bust so far for them. Is he going to be able to get the ball rolling? Ryan Shazier was a guy that people thought was going to be better than C.J. Mosley, and, you know, he didn't show that last year. And they still, you alluded to
Hayward
the secondary.
Hayward on the line.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I mean, look, the bottom, you know, if you're going to compare them and the Ravens, the one thing that the Ravens have done, they have gotten younger on defense, but they haven't gotten worse because of it. you know, but right now Pittsburgh has gotten worse. They have not been able to replace the guys like Brett Kiesel and Casey Hampton and, you know, all these guys that they had for all those years that were so good up front. I mean, they're relying on James Harrison. They're relying on him. He is a very good.
That's pretty amazing that he came back and like last year. He was done, and then it was like all the street that they brought him back, and he's like a factor for them.
Right. Yeah, I mean, so it's amazing how he is vital to them next year. So I their offense is going to be tough to stop. There is no doubt about it. But their defense has got to be a middle of the road defense. And if they are, then Pittsburgh's going to be very tough.
Where are you with Cincinnati? Who's they've made the playoffs three straight years. They've gone out. First round of the playoffs, three straight years. Everyone's has pinned that on Dalton. What did you think about their draft, and what do you think about them overall?
I mean, you know, they look. Everybody in the division had a pretty good draft. I mean, they did a good job. I mean, they're a very talented team. You know, I would expect that they're going to be right there again. I don't really see any reason to think that they're going to. That they're going to fall off the cliff or anything like that. They've got very good skill position guys. AJ Green is one of the best, if not the best in the game. their running backs Bernard and
Hill.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, he was fantastic last year. So they might
quite
have
a combo
best,
1-2.
Yeah, they might have the best running back tandem in the league. I mean, it may not that may not be far fetched to say.
Get Eifert back this year, tight end.
Yep. Yeah. I mean, you've got to be a little. You have to be wary of them. I mean, you know, there's no doubt about it that this team is putting themselves in position. You know, the question is, you know, are they going to be able to continue to do this? Which I know might sound a little ridiculous, but just kind of the idea of, you know, you've had three straight years of. You know, they haven't always had great fortune in terms of they've had injuries. You know, you had Geno Atkins missing a lot of time, Leon Hall missed a lot of time. But, you know, you've been to the playoffs three straight years. Does the losing in the playoffs, does the extra time, does all this stuff start to wear on you as a team? But I would expect, if I were a Cincinnati fan, I would expect that my team is going to be back in the playoffs because they're a very talented team. And I would expect that they're going to be right there at the very least competing for a playoff spot, if not in the playoffs again.
Yeah, I like their defensive front seven. I mean, not a huge Maluga fan. Him and Hawk, they're in the middle. But outside of that, you got, Burfict. Then up front with Dunlap, Pecco, Atkins, and Johnson. That's pretty strong. The secondary, remember the strong safety, Iokla. That was somebody the Ravens had looked at. Free safety, Nelson, and Jones and Hall at the corners. I mean, that's a pretty good defense. And then to go with the skill position offense, I mean, a lot is going to go back to Dalton, and you'll see a couple times during the year where he just looks atrocious. But there's other times where he looks downright good. And most of the time, you know, he's shown he's good enough to get to the playoffs. And then as far as going to the next level in the playoffs, you know, I don't know. He has his limitations, but there is talent there around him, and it's not just him. You know, I know the game has changed from when the Ravens won their first Super Bowl, but I would say that Dalton, to me, has like a superior quarterback than what Dilfer was. And if the rest of the team is strong, then I think that they have, which it is, I think they can get back to the playoffs. And I think if you can get to the playoffs in the NFL, then you do have more than a statistical chance of advancing, getting to the playoffs three straight years in this climate. That's an accomplishment, and they are going to be a threat again this year.
Yeah, and, you know, you can question, you know, how – I mean, look, they did go offensive line for their first two picks this year. The guy that they took in the first round was a guy that some people thought could be a top 10 pick heading into the season, but he's kind of raw, so, you know, it's a chance that he doesn't develop. Eric, people like Jake Fisher – as another guy, so you know you like the fact that they're trying to address the line, So we'll see. I mean, I don't think you can look at them and say, okay, they're a team that you would expect to drop off with. I don't see how you would expect that. Their offensive line is good. Their skill position is good. Dalton is fine. He's not one of the top 15 quarterbacks in the league, but you can win with him. They've proven that. If you're Cincinnati, where are you going to go? What are you going to do? Are you going to trade for Jake Butler? What are you going to do? I don't really think you can kind of there's nothing you don't have a choice. You have to stick with him, and he has proven that he can get to the playoffs and all. Now he's got to prove that he can win in the playoffs. But that, you know, like you said, that's also on the team too.
So the last team in the division, Cleveland Browns, and again they're always fighting to kind of an uphill battle in the North there, going against Ravens and Steelers have been consistent powers, and now, as we just mentioned, with Cincinnati going to the playoffs three straight years, that's a difficult stretch for Cleveland, always having six games against those opponents. Do you see enough that Cleveland, 7-9 last year, could potentially, 7-9 to getting over 500 is not a much. It's not much of a leap. But do you think Cleveland has enough where they could potentially be a playoff team?
Well, I mean, I guess if things were to fall right, but ultimately, no. I don't see how they have enough at wide receiver. I love the Duke Johnson pick for them. Danny Shelton was another tremendous pick for them. A lot of people like Vince Mailey from Washington State as an outside receiver. They took in with their last pick, they took Ifo Olume from Oregon, which is a guy they thought could be a first rounder. I was kind of wishing that the Ravens would have taken him in the sixth or something like that, take a shot at him. He might even miss the whole season, but you know what? That's okay.
A red shirt.
Yep. There's nothing wrong with that. So I like what they did with their draft. Is Josh McCown going to be able to be good enough, or Manziel if he's not? What are you going to have on the outside? I think Cleveland is, they're a team that always seems like they're on the come, that they're going to be right there, and then but they still can't solve quarterback, and now Josh Gordon does what he does, so now he's out for the season. I'd feel a lot better about them if he was back for the whole season, if his attitude was right and things like that. I would feel much better about them. I actually think now...
Gordon over Dwayne Bowe,
They got Bowe exactly.
And Hartline, so they won't be totally horrible, but you can't,
But no, they don't scare you.
They're
not threats that you're worried about. So I actually think there's a much better chance that they don't win, that they win less than they won last year. Even if they're a more talented team, It's just Brian Hoyer played so is all of a sudden is McCown going to play as well as Hoyer did last year? And Hoyer wasn't tremendous, but he played good. Is McCown going to be able to be good? Is Manziel could all of a sudden be good? There's a lot of what ifs there, but I think you have to like a lot of the foundation of what they're building. If you're a Cleveland fan, you have to like the way they're trying to go about building this team right now. But they just need more skill position talent, that's all.
And on the defensive side, I see, they took Shelton in the middle, former first-round pick Taylor behind him, former Maryland pick Starks, his projected starter. He's been in the league forever at this point. And linebackers, you're looking at Kruger and Mingo outside, which is it's okay. And then Dansby, Robertson, I'm not really familiar with inside. Corners you really like with Hayden. Well, I guess you would really like if Gilbert, last year's first round pick, came on, but he's not even projected to start at this point. They're going to be middling again. It's going to be interesting to see if, I saw a note the other day that they're slowly working Manziel back in the things. I'm sure they're going to start the year with McCown. And I don't know when their bye comes, but you wonder if after the bye, if they'll try to make the switch to Manziel at that point.
Yeah, and it's a tough division. I mean, look, this is a division they sent three teams last year to the playoffs, and Cleveland was able to win seven games. I mean, this is not an easy division. And, you know, I think there's a good chance that they're a 5 or 6 win team next year. And you know, but again, they're a team that at any point it can't completely shock you if they just jump up. Before we get into some basketball talk, though, before we take a quick break, what are your thoughts on the decision today about Brady? He got suspended for 4 games. Patriots lose their first-round pick next year, and they lose their fourth-round pick the following year. And they got fined $1 million, which is like us getting fined 10 cents.
We talked about it off the air briefly. It was interesting, and listening to NFL guys talk about it, depending on who you listen to, it was either a very egregious offense that the Patriots committed, or it was simply gamemanship, and you know they deserve a slap on the wrist. The best comments I saw from anybody was Bill Polian, ESPN, former executive with the Bills and the Colts, and his comment there was that you're trying to circumvent the rules for, you know, their advantage. And the NFL has to, they're always talking about protecting the shield and protecting the brand. They're obviously cognizant and being aware of the fact that you have to have the public have confidence in the, that nothing is being done to circumvent the rules that give one team an advantage over the other. So that's pretty, I thought that was pretty harsh. I do think that there will be an appeal, and I would think you're probably looking at 4 games going down to 2, but we'll see. As is, 4 games, 25% of the regular season, that might be enough to at least take home field from New England and potentially give the other teams in the AFC East a chance to actually compete for the division for the first time in forever, it seems.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, you know, like you just said, I mean, the AFC East, top to bottom, is improved. So they were going to have a harder time. This is probably going to be the hardest year for them to win a division regardless. That's number two. While I actually don't think this is a huge deal in that, you know, they're going to still beat the Colts in that game. You know, although I do think that the score of that game softened the blow of this a little bit at the time. I think this is worse than Bounty Gate, though. The Bounty Gate stuff has been going on forever, and it still is going on. I would guarantee it. The difference is the NFL wasn't looking at a $700 million lawsuit about concussions. You know, I mean, they were, and they're not looking at some $700 million lawsuit about footballs. So that's why they're not going to make this as big a deal. The problem with this is not the act; it's the cover up. You know, Tom Brady, oh, no, I don't know any difference. Look, you can't tell me there's not anybody that does any job where they use some kind of tool on a daily basis, literally on a daily basis, all the time during the day, and would not know the difference between that tool, what it feels like normal and what it feels like when it's not normal. There's no doubt about that he knew it was that. I think this is fantastic. Although I said it today, what'll probably happen is Jimmy Garoppolo they'll probably go 3-1 with him. He'll be brilliant, and they'll be able to trade him for a first round pick in the top 15. So they'll end up actually ahead of the game because of this. That's just the way it seems to work for them. But I don't agree though. I don't think that the suspension is going to get reduced. Part of me is a little. I do think that the first game back from the suspension is against the Colts. I think that's who they play Week 5, which is pretty interesting. But you know, I'm surprised that they're going to keep him out against Dallas because it's a big game against New England and Dallas. Those are two big names and stuff. But you know, I it's fantastic. You know, it doesn't take anything away. I don't know if I would go as far as to say it tarnishes his legacy. It maybe tarnishes his image, which I think are two different things, because he basically just got up there and lied. But, you know, I still don't think you can take away from him what he's accomplished. You know, like Jerry Rice was, you know, he used stick him on his gloves. Are you going to take away his accomplishments as a receiver because he did that? You know, I don't know. It's tough to say. So you know, but again,
obviously, you know, Laura, as she said, life for Brady is going to still be pretty okay when he wakes up tomorrow.
Yeah, no doubt. All right, let's take a quick break, and we'll be right back.
Baltimore Sports and Life is dedicated to the analysis and discussion of the Baltimore Orioles, the Baltimore Ravens, and the University of Maryland. Get the coverage you crave from our team of writers and over 16 hours of live streaming content every week. Every week. Join the conversations on our message board, like BSL on Facebook, and follow BSL on Twitter. BaltimoreSportsAndLife.com.
Okay, welcome back. Before we get into the NBA, let's get your thoughts on what happened with the Terps today. They've officially brought in Rashid Suleiman. He will be starting for them next year, the two guard, assuming that he graduates from Duke this summer, which it looks like he is on track to do. This shores up maybe arguably the weakness of their starting five and allows you to push other guys a little bit further down on the depth chart. So what were your thoughts on them bringing in the former Duke shooting guard?
Well, I was leaning on you for the scouting report. I mean, I've seen him in passing, but I didn't have a great feel for his game reading everybody else's comments. Now Maryland has five players in their starting five who have NBA aspirations. I mean, you see the comments from all over sports world today, all different analysts, and everybody has Maryland. They had Maryland in the top five going into next year before Suleiman. Now everyone, I mean, there's a lot of talk that Maryland's going to be the preseason number one. They are absolutely loaded. And when you look at the beyond the starting five, you got seven other useful players. You'll have a starting five off the bench of Brantley, Wiley, Nickens, Sikorsky, and Dodd. That would be a pretty solid starting five for a lot of years at Maryland, frankly. But aspirations are going to be high. Maryland's going to go from being the hunter to being the hunted because there'll be a lot of hype of Maryland going into next year. We'll see how they deal with that and handling that little change of mentality. And Maryland's going to have to cash in on next year because there will be guys leaving after the season. And Maryland's going to be the hot name in college basketball. So you want to strike while you have that opportunity. And anything less than like a 2 seed nationally going into the NCAA tournament is going to be seen as a, would have to be considered poor on Maryland's part. I mean, this is a team that you're going to at least be looking to get to the Elite Eight, and really anything short of the Final Four is probably going to feel as a letdown based off the hype that's going to ensue from this point up until next November.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be interesting to see how the rest of the conference plays out. I saw that Caleb Swanigan, who was supposed to go to Michigan State, has withdrawn his name from them. He didn't actually sign a letter of intent. It was a verbal agreement, but he's now no longer
going to Purdue.
There. Yeah, so that's a big loss for Michigan State. You know, Wisconsin lost, obviously they lost Kaminsky and Decker. Look, the bottom line with Suleiman is it's very, very simple. If Suleiman is going to have the right attitude and he's going to be mature, I think there is a very good chance that he's the best player on the team next year. If he is not going to be motivated, if this experience at Duke with dropping him from the team is not going to mature him and everything else, then bringing him in could cause this team to maybe, I don't want to use the word fall apart, but maybe not be as good as they should be. I mean, look, you know, when you look at what Duke did this year, they didn't get worse because they got rid of Suleiman. Okay, they were a team with a short bench. They knew it was a short bench when they got rid of him. Yes, it was a very talented group of players, but it was still a very short bench, and they decided that they were better off without him than they were with him, and it looks like that they were right. So I guess I don't really have
a ton of worry there because I like Nickens and Wiley a lot. Now, what Suleiman does is it takes pressure off of their shoulders. Both of them, you would would have been asking for them to take fairly big leaps in their game. At this point, their development can be, you know, it can be a little bit more gradual. But if Suleiman is an issue for whatever reason, then I would think that Turgeon wouldn't have to really put up with that. He would have other options existing, and Suleiman, you know, being, he'd only be there for the year anyway, so he'll either conform or I would imagine he'd be off the team. It's interesting, and we'll get off the Terps quickly here, but this is the third major incoming transfer to Maryland, you know, under Turgeon with Wells and Carter and now Suleiman.
Yeah, and the last thing is the thing now is this is now all on Turgeon. Okay, what can you get? You got the three guys who are going to be thrust into your lineup that you're going to hope to get major minutes from, and Carter, Suleiman, and Stone. Can you get those three guys to work with Trimble and Lehman and everybody else who's returning and work together as a unit and as a quality team? Every team has to deal with new guys every year. This is a little bit of a unique circumstance because these are guys who are coming at different points of their careers, different ages and stuff like that, coming from different systems. They're not all coming from high school, and this is the first system that they've learned on the college level. So it's going to be interesting to see how he's able to get all those parts to work together. Which
same
is
thing
probably
you said,
Juice Jack,
there's
different.
Only one ball to go around, so we'll, yep. That's something to watch as well.
Yeah, no doubt, and it's going to be interesting to see how Trimble, you know, is going to distribute with this because, you know, he with him being the scorer that he was last year. All right, let's quickly get to the NBA. It looks like the Hawks are going to tie up the series with the Wizards. You know, Wizards playing without Wall, good chance he's probably going to miss the rest of the series, which is pretty brutal. I think they probably would have won the series with him. So what do you think? You know, now it's the best 2 out of 3 with 2 of the games in Atlanta.
Yeah, I'm just looking at the box score now. It looked like Teague played his best game so far in the playoffs. He had been really struggling, and he struggled over the weekend when the Wizards went up 2-1 with without Wall in the lineup. So I knew that had been disappointing for Atlanta. If you just want to see the best basketball going forward, I think you would want to see Atlanta advance without, if Washington is going to be without Wall. But the 5 fractures in the hand and wrist, I think I saw somebody today that said the normal time frame would be 6 to 8 weeks. So I don't see how he could play, even if Washington were to advance to the next round. The other game tonight coming up, Golden State and Memphis, game 4, absolutely huge. Grizzlies are up 2-1. Both of us had Golden State winning the title. Memphis has shown up. Our question was if the Grizzlies were going to be able to score enough. Gasol and Randolph controlling the action in the paint. Grizzlies are getting credit for their defense, particularly with Allen on the perimeter. But I think you also have to look at the Golden State has missed a fair amount of open shots. Curry the other day missed at least 3 or 4 direct open looks. What happens tonight with the Splash Brothers and Golden State? Do they tie the series up tonight?
Yeah, I think they will, but I tell you what, I mean, I saw that Phil Jackson had a little jab the other day apparently on Twitter saying, you know, how are the analytics how are the teams that are basing their, you know, analytics off of threes and all, how are they going for you right now? You know, look, they're missing shots, but this was the problem with Golden State is, are they, they're a jump shooting team, you know, are they going to be able to, if they're not shooting well, are they going to be able to overcome that? Memphis is a big physical team. They play great defense. They play a playoff style. I mean, they just do. It's going to be very interesting to see with Golden State. I think there's probably a fairly good chance that Golden State, it wins the series. I would still favor them, but I think now it probably goes 7, which I did not think that was going to happen. The thing I did not see Memphis doing was that they would be able to hold. I mean, they've held them under 100 points the last 2 games, and last game was under 90, so that has really surprised me.
I think the pressure's on the MVP tonight, Curry, to, you know, have a game worthy of being the MVP and to get that series tied.
Yeah, no doubt. All right, let's move to the other series in the West. Clippers have pretty much dominated this series. It's 3-1. It doesn't look like Houston really has much of a chance. It looks like the Clippers will will probably close this out in the next game, and they get some rest, and they're peaking at the right time. They look like a pretty dangerous team right now.
First on Houston, they should be absolutely embarrassed. If Curry didn't win the MVP, the second was James Harden. I don't know how you can be disinterested on defense playing in the playoffs. He had, apparently during this year, he played of more intensity defensively than he had in past years, but he's been very passive in this series. Dwight Howard, he's probably my least favorite quality player in the league. Something about him, I don't know, just rubs it wrong. That whole team, they really should be embarrassed by their effort getting. You see teams get destroyed once, but as Scott Van Pelt and Russillo were talking about today on ESPN, you rarely see, after a team gets blown out in the playoffs one game, you rarely see it happen again in the next game. And it just seemed they just quit, which, you know, again, you should be embarrassed. L.A. playing well, Paul getting healthier. Definitely they've overwhelmed Houston, but I would have the Clippers as the underdog to either Golden State or Memphis.
Yeah, I think I would too. I think that Memphis can kind of negate some of their strength in terms of like the inside game, and you can put Tony Allen on Paul, which would probably give him fits. And I think, you know, Golden State, yes, the athleticism inside could hurt Golden State, but I still think ultimately Golden State's the best team. So, you know, you figure, I think they would just, you know, they get the ball rolling. The interesting thing with Houston, you know, they have injuries, and Patrick Beverley is a big loss because he's their defensive guy up on the perimeter. But, you know, this is 2 years in a row where they're going to lose in the playoffs, and the team that they beat is putting up 110, 120 points on them a game like Portland did last year. You know, this is not a team that's been awful defensively in the regular season, but when they get to the postseason, they're just brutal, and their style of play, going back to the analytics and shooting the threes and doing all that kind of stuff, you got to wonder if that's just not the proper playoff basketball. No matter how much things change, they still stay the same, and that seems to be the case with them.
The other game tomorrow night, Chicago at Cleveland. Did the Bulls miss their chance by not going up 3-1 yesterday?
Yep, absolutely. You can't, you know, Kyrie Irving did nothing. LeBron was 9-for-29 going into that game-winning shot. They held him to 12 points in the third quarter. You're at home. I know Gasol didn't play, but you held him to up until that final shot. You'd held him to 84 points. You had only scored 84 points. You got to find a way to win that game in the playoffs. It's going to be tough for them. I mean, it's not impossible because right now, just the injuries are the players that are hurt are really the story of this whole entire playoffs this year. So, you know, who the heck knows? But I would say Cleveland has a pretty significant edge right now in this series. And, you know, the Bulls probably win the series if they win it last night. And now I think there's a good chance they lose the series because of it.
Yeah, I think it's a good chance that Cleveland. I do think it's a missed opportunity for the Bulls not going up 3-1 yesterday. I think you got to win that game. But on the other hand, no love. Irving is definitely banged up and hurting. And a banged up Irving and just LeBron. And you look at the rest of that team, you know, J.R. Smith and Shumpert. The center, I guess Mozgov, that I'm forgetting. I mean, they have a couple of pieces, but that's not an overwhelming team. And Chicago, I still feel like Chicago can win that series, but yeah, definitely a disappointing game for them yesterday. The last few minutes of the show, one of the things that got a lot of attention this week was the drama with ESPN and Bill Simmons. I saw your take on the board, basically, that you weren't a tremendous fan of Simmons. I can't say that I am either. As far as his writing, I thought his writing was okay, and TV, I find him to be okay. But what I really do respect him for is building Grantland and giving a voice and an outlet to a lot of quality writers and giving the larger in-depth pieces, not just analytical, but just some thinking pieces, which seem to be missing in a lot of different outlets. I think he'll have success wherever he goes. I think he will also miss just the just the scope of ESPN, unless he winds up going to Turner Sports and Bleacher Report, he'll, you know, he doesn't figure to have the NBA outlet for him. But he certainly has a number of different places that he can go going forward. Just any general takes you have with that?
Well, I agree with you. I think his contribution is much bigger than him in terms of the and they're not losing Grantland. I mean, look, Grantland is probably the best sports site that you can go to in terms of articles and things like that. I don't know that any site writes anything better than what they do. And I like the fact that they, you know, they do stuff on Game of Thrones and, you know, pop culture stuff just in general. You know, it's not just sports. It's a good site to go for a whole lot of things. But I've never heard his podcast, and I don't watch a ton of NBA. So, you know, so I'm limited on a few things. But, you know, I used to hear him on, when I used to watch PTI, he would be a guest, or he would be a guest host. Quite often. I've heard him in other interviews and all that kind of stuff. And when he's not talking about the NBA, he doesn't really say anything impressive, and all he wants to talk about is Boston. So I don't really care. I mean, he's kind of a non-entity to me. I respect his basketball knowledge. I respect what he's built and things like that. It just doesn't bother me. I mean, you know, if I was, you know, I know.
It
like,
just doesn't move the needle for you either
yeah,
way.
Yeah,
which
not
I,
at all. It just doesn't.
Which I think is fair, and it's kind of my point that no matter how large Simmons is and how large Grantland is like 10% of ESPN.com's overall audience, which is, that's a sizable amount, but it's still 10%. And it's only ESPN.com. It's not everything else. It is ESPN. I think ESPN at this point is just such a behemoth that they could lose anybody, and it just doesn't matter. And they'll move on. But I am interested to see where he winds up, and I do think he'll wind up taking a fair amount of the staff from Grantland over time, at least some of the pieces. And if not, I'm interested to see what happens with Grantland in the future, and at least those writers. Last week we had a jackass of the week. Was a local, Nestor Aparicio. I could probably choose him every week. This week I'll choose Jay Mariotti, who chimed in about Simmons. Mariotti used to be a columnist, I guess, out of Chicago, and he used to do those around the horn, and he had a domestic situation and basically lost his career. Currently he's with a paper in San Francisco, kind of a not a very large paper. It's not the Chronicle, not the Examiner. I forget what it is exactly, but it's low rent, and it's perfectly designed for him. He had a column and basically tore Simmons apart, and he was also commenting on effectively bloggers as a whole, and also having analysis in those discussions. Look, there is a large, one of the other aspects of Simmons is that it led to sites like Baltimore Sports and Life, probably, that other people could have an outlet, and that is something that you have in this day and age where you can start a blog and you can write and you can build an audience. And to see somebody like Mariotti with, you know, you see his arguments over time on TV or you read his columns, and he's not a very articulate or intelligent guy. And to see him disparage Simmons or basically that whole the media that's come after, the idea that that your opinions don't matter if you're not sitting in the press box or if you're not interviewing somebody is just, it's ridiculous. There's plenty of things that you can engage and discuss. And I just found his column just disgusting, but kind of par for the course.
Yeah,
so,
I mean,
and on a better note, what are you looking forward to this week? Any things on your kind of closed out? Anything that interests you game wise? Can be local or national. What are you looking for?
Just the O's, just to see how they are able to, you know, go on their homestand and, you know, if they can get things turned around, you know, and then you know, kind of what does the state. But that'll wrap up our show tonight. Make sure you follow us on Facebook and on Twitter at Baltimore Sports and Life, and we'll be back next week.
Have a good one. See you.